Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Runner's World podcast. Each month we'll be bringing you the latest training advice, news and interviews from the wide world of running. I'm Rick Pearson, the Runner's World section editor, and I'm here with Ben Hobson, the digital editor. Ben, what have we got coming up this month?
This month we have The Guardian's Kate Carter discussing marathon running. We're speaking to the runner and author Johnny Muir, whose new book The Mountains Are Calling details the history of mountain running in Scotland. And RW's very own commissioning editor, Kerry McCarthy, is popping in to talk about diversity in distance running.
Lovely. So what have you been up to this month, Ben? Because we missed you last time round on episode 4.
I had to take a break from the intensity of podcasting. No. I was sad, actually. I missed out, but it gives me a whole world of stuff to catch you up on.
Well, tell us more.
Well, I ran a marathon.
The London Marathon?
The London Marathon. That really hot race.
Yeah.
Had a lovely time.
Yeah, you enjoyed it?
Really much. Yeah, very much. It was good. I mean, I had no agenda, so I think I had the freedom of just running a race how I wanted rather than anything else, which I think is how a lot of people do it, but I've never really done that.
Yeah.
So that was nice to do and got round. I'm now training for a triathlon.
What? No swear words on the show, Ben. Okay.
Which I used to do quite a lot of them.
Yeah.
And I haven't done one for a few years, so it's nice. The variety is good. I've been up doing
from a sort of training perspective.
Yeah, really, really nice. I feel like just it doesn't feel overwhelming, which I felt like with marathon stuff does, because that wasn't really my thing, and this is way more my thing, so this is good.
Okay, well, that sounds good.
And what about you?
Well, I went to the Scilly Isles a couple of weekends ago for a swim run by a company, you know, the Ur du Lur.
I do.
Those sort of Swedish eccentric.
The origins of.
Exactly. So this was one of their kind of events, not their Stockholm one, but one on the Scilly Isles, which are an amazing sort of set of islands just off Cornwall, about 26 miles off. And it's an amazing little event. You kind of compete in pairs. You're attached by a bungee cord. So it's a real test, not only of your endurance, but your friendship, your partner.
Wow.
It was about only about 12K of running and about 3K of swimming. And it's very much kind of run, swim, multiple transitions. Our transitioning was a weak point
right.
for us. So there's lots of like putting on the hand paddles because you're allowed paddles and stuff. But yeah, it made me think that I would like to do a few more, actually. I think the summer months lend themselves maybe to these slightly more eccentric challenges.
For sure. I've actually been doing a bit of open water swimming at my local reservoir.
Oh, right.
And I've noticed the swim run get up.
Yes.
It's very specific.
Mm-hmm.
I'd not noticed it before with the float strapped to the leg.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And all the different bits. I was intrigued. And then talking to you about it, I was like, this could work.
Oh.
I could try this out.
Well,
yeah.
Tell you what, let's sign ourselves up.
All right.
You bring the bungee cord, I'll bring the paddles.
Oh, I'm not running with you. It's far too quick. And that'll swim, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
I reckon.
Yeah, so I think that's what you want in these events. You want a bit of, you know, if one of you's better, then you can pull the other one along, literally.
Quite physically.
With a bungee cord.
Good.
But yeah, so that's what I've been up to. And then I'm going to do the Great South Run, 10 mile in October. Haven't done a 10 mile event in ages, and I quite like it as a distance because it feels like it's a bit about speed, but it's also, you know, there's an endurance aspect to it as well, and you can kind of just go for it. And I'm just kind of like, well, let's see what I can do, you know. Definitely want to try and get a PB, which would be anything quicker than 1:06. And yeah, threaten the hour. I want to threaten the hour.
Pretty rampant. Well, talking of hours, there's another one. I did an hour-specific race the other day.
Right.
So you have an hour to run as far as you can.
Away from home?
from your troubles. No, from the start line, bang, go. An hour, the clock starts counting down.
Right.
A mile loop. This is an Adidas run.
Okay.
I'm going to forget what they're called, but it's the city runs.
Yes.
And a mile loop in central London, and you had an hour to do as many of them as you could. And there was timing mats every point, one of a mile, I think.
Right.
How'd you get 8.3 miles.
Well, that's all right. That sounds pretty good.
It was fine.
Yeah, decent.
I mean, off the back of injury and all sorts of excuses. Yeah. But yeah.
Incredible time given your phantom injuries.
Thank you.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
We are delighted to have Kate Carter in the studio with us today. Kate, some of you may know from her writing exploits at The Guardian, but more importantly, as a prolific runner herself.
Prolific.
Prolific. Thank you very much for joining us, Kate.
It's lovely to be here. I think the word my mum uses is obsessive rather than prolific.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, slightly more negative.
Yeah.
Well, your prolific running, you did manage to do the sub-3-hour marathon this year.
After
a few attempts.
Yeah.
I mean, how did it feel to finally, smash that barrier?
I think about 10% excitement and about 90% relief. Just, oh, thank God for that. Just that sort of... I'm not going to claim that I'm not doing more marathons, but knowing that I don't have to put myself through that with everybody waiting for you to say, did you do it or not? Did you? It's just horrible. So now I can just do whatever. I mean, no one cares.
Yeah, and I mean,
no one cared anyway. But
well, I think they did. I think I did. I think we were discussing this earlier, and I think that there's a certain amount of exposure that social media brings to these events, and like when people are aiming for a target, you kind of keep a bit to yourself, but there's always a bit that kind of ekes out into the ether, and people see what you're attempting.
Yeah.
But I think that there was a growing pressure on you almost to sort
of... Yeah, and actually, what was interesting is my coach, Tom Craggs, who I think you guys know, when we sort of first locked in that I was going to do Seville Marathon, and we sort of got towards the start where you do the kind of about 12 weeks, right, come on, we're going to really focus on this. He said, I want you to think about who you talk about with this because that was exactly his point, that there's a sort of pressure on you if you're kind of on social media and people read stuff that you write, that however silly you feel for feeling that as pressure, it is, you know, that's what you feel it as, that's what it is. So I didn't really tell anyone that I was doing it. I told I told you randomly, and then very few people.
I got it out.
And thumbscrews. obviously my family, but that was pretty much it. I didn't mention it on the blog. I deliberately didn't mention it on Twitter or Instagram or anything like that. I didn't post the, you know, the kit layout pictures or the kind of, and even the training sessions in the run up that were really obviously marathon training sessions. When they went on Strava, I would just sort of fudge it.
Yeah. Oh, me? Just another 21-mile run?
Yeah, just fancy the 23-mile run with some blocks at marathon pace for the hell of it, you know? Who doesn't?
Do you think that that's something that you would encourage other people to do if there's an elusive running goal?
Yeah.
To actually go and take yourself away from the kind of, the public eye?
Yeah.
And just,
yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think there's different ways of putting that pressure on yourself. And it might be that you've sort of stated it on Twitter and you feel like people are waiting. It might be just your club mates. It might be your other half, whatever it is. And the other kind of pressure that people often feel when they have those arbitrary targets is the sort of tyranny of the watch. So try running without a watch. I saw a friend of mine at a race yesterday, and he's been running park runs for the last couple of years and hasn't been able to break 20. He's got a PB quicker than that from a while ago,
right,
but he's just not been able to break 20. And he went out the other week and he's just not going to wear the watch. Not going to wear the watch at all. Just didn't even sort of not look at it. Just completely left it behind. And he ran 19:40. Mm. And he said it felt easier because he wasn't constantly kind of having that little...
Completely.
Is it on?
Especially shorter races. Mm. You can get really tied up in that.
Yeah.
Quick check.
Yeah.
And the amount of time that you're probably just changing head angle and not actually thinking about running
because
you're just flicking at your watch the whole time.
Yeah, and sometimes I mean, the part run on Saturday, and I was pacing friend for a PB, and they have K markers in the part run.
Right.
But someone had told me, a friend of mine who was also doing it, told me, don't believe the first one because it's always in the wrong place. And lo and behold, we should have gone through in about 4 minutes. Mm. And I looked at my watch as I went past it, it was 3:35. I thought, that's a pretty punchy first K for a... Yeah, so, but it was completely in the wrong place. He said he reckoned it was, for him, 20 seconds out.
Right.
So that, probably about right. So yeah. If you had been not known that, you'd have been either, oh my God, I'm going to break the world record, or been really panicked by it. But if you don't know and you're just running at your, you know, it's fine. And also I think it freaks you out when you think that you have to run every kilometre, every mile of a marathon at exactly the same pace. Because in your head, you've got to break that goal. I've got to run underneath, you know, I don't know, if you're trying to bake 40 for 10K, 4-minute Ks. And if one of those Ks isn't under four, you think, that's it, it's gone. And you sort of let yourself come back and just go, oh, well, it was still a good try.
Yeah, definitely.
But if you didn't know that one was, you know, 4:02, but then the other, either side of it were 3:57, you wouldn't feel it. You wouldn't be able to tell.
No. I think you're right. I think also some people can run faster than they think they can. And I think a watch can hold people back a little bit. I ought to be running. I'm like a 7-minute mile person.
Yeah.
I'm going faster. My watch tells me I'm going faster than that. Yeah. I'm not really thinking about how that feels.
Yeah.
But my watch tells me that I'm going at 6:50. So therefore, I should take my foot off the gas.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely kind of a mental barrier there.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And either not wearing it, or I've got really good at wearing, because I like to, I'm, you know, a data geek. I like to look at the data afterwards, but I've got really disciplined about wearing it and just not looking at it once. So I wore it. I did a 10-mile race yesterday and I wore it and I stopped it at the finish, but I did not look at it once. I mean, my spares were all over the place. It's probably a good job I didn't. But some people, I think, struggle with that. I've got a friend who I basically had to, to sort of bully him into doing this, because I knew he was going to run faster. So he put gaffer tape over it.
Right.
So, because it's a bit harder. It's just like a little barrier to cheating.
I used to be really kind of evangelical about not wearing a watch. And then I realised I became the person who was asking people the time they're on.
Oh, right.
So it'd be like, you know, like 10 miles into like a half marathon. And I'd be like, oh, mate, yeah, are we on for, like, you know, that? And it'd be like, yeah, we are. And I realised that actually I'm just sort of throwing the responsibility onto other runners. Yeah.
What pace are we running at?
Oh, right. Oh, cool, great. Yeah. I'll just run with you if that's right.
Yeah.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So that's interesting. So I was looking for tips for people who are, like, going after an elusive running goal.
Mm.
And I think one of them might be to take yourself away from social media, maybe, and the other one might be a watch. Is there anything else that you think about that actually has helped you?
I think we tend to get obsessed as runners, like doing races a lot. You get a sort of pre-race ritual where you have, you know, the same dinner and the same breakfast and everything. And there's, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. You certainly shouldn't go out and start eating a curry for breakfast before a race. But I think there's also when you get to a mental block about something where you've tried the same thing over and over again and it hasn't worked, then it is time to try something different. I mean, food's a bad example because that's definitely not where to experiment. But just try a different type of race, or you know, try kind of adding a completely new thing to your running routine. You know, take up, I don't know, Pilates, or swap an easy run for swimming, or just sort of mix it up a bit so you feel like you've done something differently. And I think that sort of stays in your head a bit when you come to do your new crack at that goal. You kind of think, this isn't going to be the same as last time, because it hasn't, the whole process has not been the same as last time. And you know, you don't have to go and, like, I mean, for a marathon, you know, normally you'd run your half marathon and you'd sort of use it as a bit of a benchmark. And if it was good, it would be, you know, a good sign. If it's bad, you know, God, it's terrible. And I didn't really do, in the run-up to Seville, because Seville is so early in the year in February, there's not a lot of races in January, February that you can kind of do as testers.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cross-country and trail runs and stuff, but that's not really going to be kind of helpful for times. So I didn't really do much in the run-up to it either. And that was not a bad thing, I think, because I've done enough races that I don't need race practice.
Yes.
So just trying different things, sort of just tweaking stuff, I suppose.
Yeah.
Freedom. A bit of freedom.
Yeah.
I think, you know, people get very headstrong about what is right or wrong.
Yeah.
I think that's where someone just being a bit like, hey, relax.
Yeah.
You can just, you know, be a bit flexible and try this and see if it works.
Yeah, definitely.
We were talking with Paul Tonkinson last month, and he was saying he did sub-3 marathon and then went on a kind of extended 12-month victory lap where he kind of gained half a stone and the rest of it. But I don't sense that's been your approach. I think you still have ambitions over the marathon to be faster.
Yeah, because I listened to your podcast with him, and he was like, there's people who, they go for a goal, they've done the goal, and then it's like, yep, that's ticked, right, I'll look to different things, different goals, different distances, whatever. I... Yeah, I got my sub 3, and then I was immediately like, right, well, 2:55 then. That's just kind of how I am, I suppose.
Right.
And it's nice to know that feels less kind of pressured, because yes. I know I can run a sub 3 now, so that's fine, and anything under that's great. But it's not this kind of weird, totally arbitrary barrier that I have to break. It's just, yes. I'd quite like to go for a PB. That's basically it.
Yeah. You might run better like that, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah.
Would you change your approach?
Not radically. I know there are things I could do better or more of. I'm a bit rubbish at sort of doing all the kind of core and strength and conditioning stuff that I could do. I mean, you don't have to do a huge amount of it, but I never skip runs, but I do skip that stuff.
Right.
I tend to be quite, when I know there's a deadline, a marathon coming, I tend to be quite good. I do my homework, but the sort of rest of the time, I'm a bit like, meh, I'm tired, I just want my dinner. Yeah.
Are you going to the gym to do the sort of strength conditioning stuff or at home?
Yeah. No, I do it almost all at home, because I spend enough time running, and then I've got kids, so, you know, it's just sort of easier to do it at home.
Yeah.
And I can, you know, because then I can do it after they're in bed or while they watch something, or, you know, there's no kind of... And then just faffing around getting to the gym and back and stuff is just wasted time.
I know what you mean. Really. I know what you mean. I think the kind of home circuit.
Yeah.
If you've got a few props, kind of like a couple of kettlebells or something.
Yeah, we've got a garden full of kettlebells. I think we might have a kind of world-leading collection of kettlebells. I can lift two of them.
Right, oh,
the other ones, if they need to be moved, I have to get my husband to actually move them. Literally can't lift them up. But when my oldest daughter was little, really little, she got really obsessed with the kettlebells in the garden. She used to run out and try and lift them up and stuff.
Right.
And so my mother-in-law knitted her a kettlebell. She made her this kind of weighted kettlebell with like a sort of bell inside it.
I think I'd use that one.
Yeah.
That's about my weight. Yeah.
That's really funny. Yeah. Oh, that easier session today. I was on the knitted one.
Yeah. Still a bit sore the next day though, a bit doms.
Because Ben was pointing out to me before you arrived that I kind of forget this, that you're not a lifelong runner. It's not something that you were like really good at running growing up. It was like a later thing, right?
Yeah, I started when... So I've got two kids. I started when the little one was a baby, and I hadn't really done any running. I did do a triathlon about 10 years ago or something, right. But the running was a bit I hated, and didn't really, you know, do anything afterwards. And then, so I had two kids, and then I basically used to have a window about half an hour in the evening where my husband would come home, but it was sort of half an hour before the, you know, ritual starts.
Yeah.
And you can't, I mean, I would probably, at that point, I would probably have preferred to go for a swim or even a bike ride or something, but you just don't have time, or at least it's completely pointless doing, you know, that amount of exercise, because it's probably about 30 seconds of the pool and you're out again.
Yeah.
So I started the Catch to 5K. I mean, I really couldn't run till the end of the block. I remember like literally not being able to run to the end of the block, and it's a short block as well. and I just sort of went from there. And I think it's not an uncommon experience for, in my experience, particularly women, once they've had kids, to get really into running because of the sort of headspace and the alone time as well.
Yeah.
Just being able to be by yourself, which is kind of rare when you spend your day with a baby and a small child.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, fair enough.
I definitely think the time thing as well. Mm. As you say, like half an hour running is a decent amount of time running, but anything else that involves a changing room or kit or something faffy.
Yeah. Or even like, and it's sort of always, even an easy run is kind of a steady state of exercise, isn't it? You're kind of exercising, your heart rate's almost immediately going to be into a exercise zone.
Yeah.
There's almost nothing else that really does that. I mean, I suppose a spinning class or something like that, but then you have to go
somewhere.
I was having a random conversation with my dad the other day, who was asking me how many, like, what's the ratio between running and cycling, in that how many hours of cycling would have to equate to doing 1 hour of running. And I don't know. I mean, Ben, you're a cyclist, you know, but I was thinking like maybe 3-1 or something.
Yeah, I think
it's about that. Much like running, it depends on effort. But I mean, I can go out on a bike and really hammer myself for an hour, and I'll look at calorie burn and be like, oh, I mean, that's like a, it's like a 5K.
Well done, you've burned half a kilo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So sometimes it's a bit... Yeah, running is one of the best for that.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, it does sort of ruin you though for other sports because of that, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I remember I was still playing football when I was first getting into running, and I was a bit like, my marathon training, I'm going to be so much better than the rest of people at football. And all it meant was I was the guy who went and got the ball when it went for a throw-in.
Because you'd long distance.
Just amazing kind of 70% speed. And I was worse. I was just kind of like...
Well, the one thing that marathon training makes you really good at is running in that direction and that direction alone. So being
sort of straight lines.
The ball might be over there, but I can't turn, I'm afraid.
Very, very good when the ball wasn't on the pitch.
Yeah.
Very kind of obedient at kind of going to collect it. It's funny. Yeah, it wasn't kind of very specific for, but you get that. You get that. And this is a little bit off topic, but you get lots of ex-sports stars, and I think footballers like Michael Owen and stuff trying marathons, and they're normally quite bad. Actually.
Yeah. Well, that's I always think footballers are sprinters, essentially, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's all sprints. I mean, it's quite a lot of little sprints. But do you ever see those ridiculous claims? Sometimes you get some website that will go, so-and-so in the NFL
World Cup.
Yeah, they'll be like, he did that pass and then ran quicker than Usain Bolt. Like, no, he didn't. Firstly, it wasn't a standing start. Secondly, he reached something approximate to that speed for about 1 second in the middle for about 5 metres. It's just not the same thing.
Yeah, it's just a headline, isn't it?
Yeah.
There was a thing about the distances the ref covers just last week. It was about 10K.
It's quite good, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's because I think they've all put trackers or whatever on footballers, and they mostly cover about 10K. Although there's some of them that
intervals, 10K of intervals.
Yeah,
over 90 minutes with a big break in the middle as well. I have very little sympathy for footballers.
Me too. They get paid a lot of money.
Yeah, they get paid. So, when they get to the end of it, they're so tired. Someone get fitter then. You get paid like 500 grand a minute or something.
Yeah.
If I got paid that much, I reckon I could smash out a decent sprint.
I would try and be as fast as Usain Bolt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So it's coming up to Runner's World's 25th anniversary, basically. Oh. So part of this, I've been looking back through the annals of Runner's World and the letters and looking at some kind of recurring themes. And one of them is heckling, both for men and women, actually. And it seems very prevalent in the early 90s that when runners went out, they would regularly be insulted, abused, physically hurt by groups of people. It's not something that I have experienced that much, but do you feel like that is still a big issue facing runners in 2018?
Well, certainly. I don't know a woman who hasn't been heckled or, had inappropriate or, sort of even well-meaning but uncalled for comments by people.
And mansplaining.
Yeah, I've been mansplained by a few people, like how to run. there was one great example. This guy, I was running home from work, and this guy was, he was at a light, so I was standing next to him, and then we ran off, and then I was clearly trying to get past him, but he wasn't having any of that. And this kind of kept happening, and then we got to the embankment, and there was a long, long stretch, and he was clearly just not having any of this, because he kept, every time he got to the lights, he'd start sort of patronisingly asking me questions about running and stuff.
Right.
Like, have you ever tried, have you considered doing intervals and things like this? And then he just wouldn't leave me alone. And then he was clearly determined not to be dropped as well. So I just kind of, over the course of about 2 miles, just kind of put the accelerator on just a little bit, till we got to Battersea Park, at which point I was like, I got to about marathon pace or something, and got to the end, turned around, and he was basically throwing up in a bush. That was excellent.
I think that's just.
He should have done some more intervals, that guy.
Yeah,
he should have done some more intervals.
Absolutely, but more seriously, I mean, obviously, you do get quite a lot of it, and I think when I run on my own, because I tend to do a lot of running to work and back, and it's the same route all the time, and it's kind of central London, not sort of Soho central London, but along the embankment or something. I listen to music just to sort of distract me.
Yeah,
and. And then sometimes I don't. And when I don't, I realise what I'm missing, which is not a lot, is all the comments. Because you don't hear it when you've got music in, which is a really good reason to listen to music.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
And I just didn't... Like, the other day I ran through Farringdon and Clerkenwell down to the river. And there was about 5 comments in the course of about 2 miles. Just like, all right, darling, kind of...
Yeah, yeah. Looking,
sort of some comment on your legs or something like this.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Maybe it was just a really bad day, or maybe it just happens all the time and I just don't hear it.
Mm.
It's just, yeah.
What about you, Ben? I mean, you're like a kind of 6-foot-something bloke. Do you get heckled?
I mean, it's happened to me on like maybe three occasions, and is the only other the time most recently. It wasn't in London; it was actually back in Gloucestershire,
right?
And it was just like lads in a van, and I was wearing short shorts. I think that's like they'll just take anything,
yeah.
And I was wearing proper running shorts, and they thought that was hilarious for some reason. And the thing is, I'm getting on, and my hearing isn't great, so they shouted at me. And I just asked them what, because I couldn't... Clearly, they were heckling me, but I was a bit like, I can't hear you, because it was the van and me running and stuff. So they said it again, still didn't catch it.
Yeah.
By this point, they kind of stopped the van almost to try and heckle me. And it's lost all impact, because I'm sort of asking them to repeat themselves.
Yeah.
And that this, and then they sort of give up. And I was like, oh, I think that was a heckle. And I'm not sure what they actually said in the end of it. But anyway, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
But no, I mean, clearly the difference between my experience running and harassment is totally different. And I'm very alien, I think, to what other... When people tell me stories about what they've experienced. And last year we actually did a piece on this. And the stats that we got back were a big shock, actually, in terms of... female experience when running, and I think it's baffling, honestly.
I mean, I think it has, you know, to be optimistic about it, I imagine it has slightly shifted and is shifting. It's still, there's a lot of people who still think that's acceptable, but hopefully less as a proportion than 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And partly because I suppose 20, 30 years ago, your letters and stuff, there was still sort of the beginning of the big boom,
exactly.
Wasn't it? So it was probably slightly less common experience to do, less... big races and things like that, so that people were aware of it as a recreational thing that lots of people did. I mean, everybody now knows. I mean, there can't be a person alive who doesn't know someone who's doing a 5K, 10K, half marathon, marathon.
Yeah.
So,
I think you're right. Running's become very normal, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And more popular.
But that kind of makes it more bizarre. Because surely, like, if that's the case of people must know someone, then these men who are shouting things more than likely must have a family member who's running.
Yeah. Maybe know a woman, even.
Yeah, well, I doubt it.
some of them, not so sure, yeah.
So, I don't know.
One of the best responses one of the readers said was that she would get a comment and she would just encourage people to, oh, come and join me on the run. 20 miles, let's go and do it. Apparently that was enough to put people off. They actually were like, oh, no, you're right.
I did once, actually. Someone once did. It wasn't really a heckle, but it was more elderly person, it might even have been a woman, actually. She says something like, oh, looking a bit tired, dear. And I was like, I've just run 21 miles, you try it. Try to get fresh at the end of that.
Oh, that's almost a kind of caring heckle, isn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was quite sweet.
Like, yeah.
And you do, I mean, I have had that, you know, a few of that as well. Like, oh, well done, you know, good for you, that kind of thing, which is sweet.
Yeah, exactly. That's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
On a more sort of positive note, what are you finding inspiring in running at the minute? Apart from the Runner's World podcast.
Well, I mean, can one really see beyond that?
Rarely.
Yeah. I mean, I love watching running. I love running as a sport, athletics. So I always love kind of watching the Diamond Leagues and stuff in summer. Yeah. And I mean, it kind of makes me want to go and run. And it, while also knowing that, you know, I couldn't run 100 metres at the pace they're running 10K in or anything like that. So it's not really kind of directly comparable, but it still kind of gets me excited.
Do you think there's a general, or do you wish there was more interest in the elite side?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish there was, because I think there's some brilliant stories that people just don't know, and I think they would... I think that it's like, you know, football is... all-consuming when it comes to the sports pages and so on. It's just all football, really. And there's not a lot of characters in it. They've all been media-trained to within an inch of their lives. They all say exactly the same thing. Everybody has access to the same press conference anyway. So you kind of get, you know, the kind of gossip currency stories of a footballer is kind of transfer rumours and the odd of, you know, outrageous thing that kind of goes viral or whatever. Whereas... I think athletics is kind of the opposite. There's some amazing people with incredible stories who do athletics around the world, but no one really hears them because they are, because it's such a small proportion of the coverage that, people see, that there's really only room for X person one in this time.
I mean, it's not elite level, but it's a similar thing. So that I'm going to forget names, but the second place lady at the Western States, she's got a PhD in engineering at the same time as obviously being a phenomenal ultra runner. And I was like, I had no idea who this person was. And I don't run ultras, so I take them. I think they're hugely motivational. I'll read stories and watch videos about ultra running because I'm just like, I think people who run ultras are phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I'm not in that culture, so I don't know the people.
Yeah.
So I was straight away, but I was like, who is this?
Because that's just amazing characters.
I struggled to have breakfast and then go for a run, and she's got a PhD. I was just like, this is insane. So I think stories of that level, I think, are great.
Yeah, or even like Laura Muir, you know, she's obviously a bigger name, but... Yeah, she's done a vet's degree, which is, by all accounts, a pretty intense degree to do, which plenty of people struggle with, you know, just doing. And she's done it while becoming our, you know, greatest athlete, basically.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing.
Yeah. On the topic of ultra running, is that something that you'd like to go into?
Give no.
Are you hang out with some people who
I
do like it?
I hang out with way too many people who like it. I'm, like, surrounded by them.
Yeah.
I'm holding out. I don't know. I've got unfinished business with going faster, you know, for me, relatively. And I am not prepared to stop that. And I kind of think if you get really into ultra running, that becomes... I had this conversation with Darren And, who's writing a book about ultra running, and he's just done the Navarrete this weekend. I was saying, I think ultra running is a different sport. I think it's as different from... you know, the kind of races that we do, the sort of middle, you know, not middle distance, but kind of, you know,
10K
endurance,
half marathon,
but in the middle. Yeah. It's as different from that as a 100-metre sprinter is from us.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it's just completely separate sport.
Yeah, separate skill set.
Yeah, and it's obviously you have to be super fit to do it, like, really well and everything, but it's just not running for me.
Yeah.
It's ultra running, which is separate.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of it isn't running.
Mm.
For the vast majority of people doing a mountain ultra, it's hiking. It's, you know, it's a kind of endurance event of a bit of running, a bit of hiking, a bit of, you know, trying to stay awake for 6.5 days in the trot, whatever it is. I kind of categorise it as something differently.
Yeah.
And I'm not interested in doing that at the moment. I'm not, never say never, but...
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think it is. It's not just a little bit longer than a marathon.
No.
There obviously are
ones that are like, I don't know, 50K, say.
And I never quite see the point of that.
I wonder if that's partly just sort of ticking the box, right, I've done an ultra
now. Did you see Steve Way's Comrades?
Yeah. Weirdly, this is the only one that tempts me as Comrades. And I think it is basically because it's really a road race. So,
yeah. You know. His pace was phenomenal.
I know.
Sub 6 minute mile.
Yeah.
The whole way.
Yeah, 90K.
But that's his comfort zone. Yeah. That's the thing about him. He's like this, you know, he's a pair of lungs on a pair of legs, basically. He can just hold that pace for an eternity.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. Yeah. I was talking before we started about the 10-mile race and thinking, oh, what could I do over that? And it really puts it in perspective. It's like, well, I don't think I could have that pace over 10 miles. So.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
A mile.
There you go.
For me.
Steve Way is better than me, shocker.
Exclusive to this podcast.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
One of the questions we've been asking our readers this month is where they think running will be in 25 years' time. Looking into your crystal ball, what do you think some of the developments that might be around the corner?
I don't know, two things that kind of interest me at the moment are very different. Well, firstly, just that I think running is becoming increasingly, as more and more people do it, it's becoming more and more kind of polarised, but not with two groups, but like hundreds of groups.
Yeah.
And you see that with all the kind of new clubs that are coming along, the kind of crews rather than clubs. And there's sort of all these splintery little groups of people who really strongly identify with that group, but sort of not with any other.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably going to carry on. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just how the kind of landscape
is. Not even running.
Yeah.
It's more just the group is the group and running is secondary.
Yeah.
Which
exactly.
is, again, not a bad thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just sort of social and friendship and everything. Those things are really great. It's just, you know, it's just sort of how it's going. But the other thing I think is really interesting is that the whole kind of, did you see the other day that the Royal College of GPs are going to prescribe parkrun?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that is really interesting and potentially, like, if you got every adult in the UK who is physically capable of like going doing catch to 5K and then sort of doing part run, you would save the NHS so much more money than a sugar tax would or does. You know, it would transform.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It has transformed people's lives.
Yeah.
I mean, part one is just a fantastic thing.
Yeah.
And we should be so proud of it coming from a South African, it's English, kind of.
For sure.
Yeah, and I think what Paul Sinden Hewitt's done is just unbelievably amazing. It should be prescribed.
The availability now is just, you go on parkrun and you look for your local race.
Yeah.
And you can do, London's, we're living in our little London bubble, but you can do probably like four if you really want it. Like, you could just pick.
Yeah.
Because it's not, there's every green space.
Absolutely.
It's
and
great. More,
and if you, don't have one near you when you're cross about it, set it up.
Yeah.
And then your kids can do the Sunday one. And, it's just amazing what he's done and how it's taken off. And I think it has such potential for health as well.
Yeah. It's hard to think of a better or bigger thing that's happened to recreational exercise
I
think.
I completely agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kate, thanks very, very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
To the Runner World podcast. Yeah, it's great to hear more about your own running journey and what you're going to plan to do next and the rest of it. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
I think to touch upon something that we talked with Kate about is the harassment, specifically for female runners. Off the back of last year's Running When Female article that we had and the stats around it. I haven't really seen anything new stat-wise of late, but I've seen more and more things on social media about it, particularly sort of video of a woman being attacked in the US, out running by a driver who pulled over and, I assume, tried to get her in a car.
Right.
She fought back brilliantly.
Yeah.
And he sped off. It seems to be a conversation that ebbs and flows, and I feel like it should be flowing more than ebbing.
Yeah, right.
But you've recently seen
some
a study.
Stuff on over at iRunFar. They did it was American stats, so some things feel less applicable here. But yeah, I mean, everything's saying that women, this is about trail running, but felt significantly less safe on trails than men do. Sort of unwanted following for women was about 16% of had experienced that, compared to 4% of men had someone following them they didn't want to. Sexual proposition, 7% of women had that, only 1% of men. Men are more willing to run on trails at night than women, so 45% of men, 21% of women. So big difference in gender.
Yeah.
And it's a shame, isn't it? And I wonder what can be done about it, because you hope that kind of these running routes are... It should be available to both sexes.
Yeah, I don't think anyone should feel... It's different. I mean, trails are very interesting. I mean, urban environments where capacity of people, you sort of feel like, it shouldn't, but it happens. Whereas on a trail, that separation feels slightly more sinister. Like, there's an element to that, which is...
Yeah, the remoteness to it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's a conversation we want to continue. Anyone listening who has a story or an opinion on it, please email us at podcast@runnersworld.co.uk.
we would like to hear from you because we think it's still something that should be discussed.
So, yeah, we had some sad news last week. So running lost the great Don Ritchie, who died at age 73. Over a stellar career, the Scottish ultra-running legend broke multiple running records over distances from 50k to 200k. He was nicknamed the Stubborn Scot and showed an almost superhuman ability to push ever onwards, refusing to slow as the miles and pain mounted. Perhaps the greatest of all his achievements was set over the 100k distance. Ritchie's time of 6 hours, 10 minutes, 20 seconds is the equivalent of running back-to-back 238 marathons.
Oh, my God.
And then another 10 miles at the same pace. Unsurprisingly, 40 years on, it's still the world record. Writing for Scottish Distance Running History to congratulate Ritchie on his MBE 23 years ago, ultra runner Dave Cooper said, "The quiet man from Elgin has been a great ambassador for the sport for many years, and his superb array of world record performances and steely determination on road and track is in sharp contrast to his modest, self-effacing demeanour." So, yeah, tribute to Don Ritchie there, running lost a genuine hero there. Staying north of the border, our next interview is with Edinburgh-based runner and author Johnny Muir, whose new book, The Mountains Are Calling, details the history and continuing appeal of Scottish mountain running. We caught up with Johnny to find out about the motivation behind the book and why he thinks runners should head to the UK's high places.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Welcome to the Runner's World podcast. I want to start by asking you, what was the inspiration behind The Mountains Are Calling?
I've read a huge amount of literature on hill running over the years, and I thought the sport needed a voice in Scotland. A lot of literature on mountain running has been focused around the latest jigs or around the Bob Graham round, and to me that was really narrow, and I wanted to celebrate the sport in Scotland. And the title of the book, The Mountains Are Calling, emerged as it went on. Really, it wasn't a title I had in my mind when I began, because the unifying theme of all the people I spoke to and all the experiences I had was that people just loved going to the hills to run, and it wasn't really about how fast they ran or how good they were. What bonded everyone was just a brilliant experience of being among Scotland's mountains.
And I guess that's something that you've got, you know, first-hand experience about, you know, alongside the discussion of all the kind of greats of mountain running. There's also mention of your own challenge, which is the Ramsey Round, which would be familiar to some readers, but essentially it's kind of the Scottish equivalent of the Bob Graham Round. Did you feel that it was important for you to kind of throw yourself in, you know, with both feet into running, rather than being just a kind of observer? You wanted to be a kind of participant in the Scottish mountain scene.
Yeah, I think for me, when I started writing it, or certainly writing it seriously, I think two things were important to me. And one was credibility, and the other was accountability. Mm. And I thought the credibility required me to live in Scotland, to live in an area where you could easily get to the hills, be part of a Scottish hill running club. And with that credibility came accountability. So I was writing about events and people and places, and certainly with the people, that they're people I'll have to face up to the next week, or, you know, all the people that are in this book. I'm going to see them all again this summer. And they're not my friends. I've treated them with sort of a journalistic distance. But I'm accountable to them. I'm not just going to disappear to London. And certainly with me doing not just Ramsey Round, but the racing, I think a degree of credibility was required. It wasn't just me talking the talk. I was literally going out and demonstrating that I could do the things that the people I was writing about were also doing.
So you're now Edinburgh-based, Johnny, but you spent several years living in London. What do you think the mountains offer a runner that the roads cannot?
I mean, yeah, firstly, I think running's fantastic, whether you're running on the road or trail or running up a mountain. I think for me, and I think people that also go to hills, it's that sense of complete detachment from normal life that I don't feel like I get on the roads anymore. You go to hills and it's a place that's just free of commercialism, and it's just a place where running's a little bit harder and a little bit more challenging, and you have to be a bit more confident and a bit more confident to be able to do it. Now, it doesn't mean everyone can't do it, but you need to feel confident enough to do it. And I just have a feeling when you're running in the hills, the experience of running is wonderful anyway, isn't it? But the experience of running in the hills just magnifies their sensations. And there's been so many times I've been out to see sunsets or sunrises or run through the night or seen wildlife, etc. And you realize how lucky you are to be able to go to the hills and see these things. And of course, mountain landscape is just innately inspiring. So for me to be able to combine mountains and hills and running, to me, those two things, or those things are just indivisible. For me, there is not running without mountains, and there is not mountains without running.
Well, I think a lot of people are starting to agree with you, Johnny, particularly when we look at what's happening to Scotland in September with the Sky Running World Championships coming your way. Do you feel that we're about to experience a bit of a golden age of mountain running north of the border?
I mean, yes, the Sky Running World Champs are held in Glencoe in September. It's certainly a real coup for Scotland. It's only in its fourth year, Sky Running in Scotland. A golden age? Possibly. It's hard for me to judge. I mean, it's certainly becoming more and more popular. That popularity is inevitably limited by the fact that sport is quite hard. And you know, there can be as many you know, inventions or aids or gadgets in running, but you know, you can never make running up a hill any easier.
Yeah.
And so I think the popularity is limited simply by it being a hard thing. You know, it's not parkrun, for example. But I think the popularity is a good thing, and I think that the role of hills should be to inspire people and to give some people something to aspire to. You know, we do live in a bit of an insipid world, don't we, where our heroes are often sort of celebrities, and I think if people can find inspiration in the mountains, that's a good thing. So whether that leads to a golden age of mountain running, I don't know, but there are certainly more people doing it, and there are more and more events that are geared, maybe not mountain running, but are geared around hills, that might be more better described as trail running, trail in inverted commas.
I think just touching on the whole notion of commercialization, and you sort of spoke briefly about mountain running being sort of separate from road running, and the fact that you can escape that. I mean, you've got things like guided tours of the Bob Graham Round now, and would you say there's a danger of mountain running being commercialized in any way?
I mean, yeah, of course, mountain running is being commercialized, and I'm much to blame as anyone else. I've written a book about the subject, so I'm part of the problem. You know, there is more money coming into sport because it's becoming more popular, and that's just inevitable. Things like Bob Graham Round being guided tours, I think each their own. If people are prepared to pay for it, then that's okay. There's been criticism recently about how trod, sort of informal footpaths are being created on the Bob Graham Round, and how that's a bad thing. I can't see how anything related to the Bob Graham Round could ever be a bad thing. As I said before, with being inspired, or people having aspirations, if people are seeing running around the hill 24 hours as a good thing, I don't think it matters if they're doing it guided or if they're doing it solo and supported. You know, it really is each to their own. Isn't that the beauty of the hills? We should be able to use them as we wish. Of course, we don't want them being commercialised to the extent that that the whole point of going to the mountains is ruined. But you know, I think if mountains are going to be more popular, commercialism is inevitably going to follow on, which is, of course, at odds with the ethos of the sports.
Yeah, I guess so. It's kind of that kind of simplicity and something kind of pure about mountain running that I think maybe feels under threat by those kind of developments. There's some great physical benefits from being out in that kind of landscape, but I think a lot of people are heading to wild places also for mental health. Do you get a sense that that's a big motivation for heading to the mountains to run or walk?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, people are starting to say that, you know, whether that's a mother who, you know, has got, or a father who's got young children and just needs to get out the door to escape for half an hour, whether that's someone with a high-pressurised job. For example, someone I spoke to is the chief executive of Aberdeenshire Council. My name is a chap called Jim Savage for the book. So, you know, he's running a multi-million pound business, and for him, hill running is his escape. But obviously, good for his mental health. So for me personally, I'm not consciously aware of running in the hills helping my mental health, but subconsciously, of course it is. And I think certainly when you're doing things like Ramses Round, or things that are really technical, or things in bad weather, or things at night, there's that sense that nothing matters at all, but the next step, the next handhold, and the next thing you do, and you're so concentrated, you're in this state of flow. Where time and distance just becomes irrelevant. I was running just a few days ago in the Cairngorms, and some of my colleagues from school there, I've been out for 3.5 hours, about 20 miles or 19 miles in the hills. And I came back, and these people couldn't believe what I'd done, but to me, it didn't feel that long because I was so focused on basically not falling over.
Yeah.
And I said, focused on just the next step, the next bit of rock, the next bit of screen, and just being very much in the moment where time and distance, you know, largely gets pushed to one side.
Mm.
It doesn't feel like that on the road. Sometimes 5K can feel like purgatory on the road sometimes.
Yeah, I think you're right. It can be less kind of immersive. I think there's something very immersive about kind of off-road running. Maybe, like you say, because you need to be, for safety reasons, you need to be in the moment.
Often when you're running at night and there's just you and the beam of the head torch, the world narrows to such an extent that everything else has to be pushed out. The worries about family or money or your job or other things, like everything else just gets pushed out and you just focus on the moment and just being.
I think that's true, and to take it another level, I mean, mountain running is quite an insular sport, and that often can come across as perhaps a little unfriendly to newcomers. I know that the fell running community is quite sort of insular. Is that justified, though? Is that reputation really a thing, or is it just everyone's running their own race?
I was interviewing a chap for the book some years ago, and I wanted to record him, like we are now.
Yep.
And he said, no, I'm a hill runner, and I'm an introvert, therefore I do not want to be recorded. So I was back to old school shorthand notes on a piece of paper. And I sort of agreed with him at the time, but at the same time, I came to my own definition of hill runners, and I call them introverted extroverts. You know, to run up and down a hill in bad weather and to risk events, etc., there's got to be something a bit more unusual about your character. So I think the people who run can appear to be quite insular, but I think that insular, as I said, you know, I think that introvertedness actually disguises the extrovert. Certainly, certainly with the English scene, I remember going to race at Pendle.
Right.
It's not a criticism of the English scene, but I remember racing at Pendle and feeling, you can hear me talk now, I don't talk with a Lancastrian or a Yorkshire accent, and going to Pendle and feeling totally foreign because no one sounded like I sounded. It felt really quite parochial. A wonderful race, wonderful spirit that the race was running, but it felt quite parochial. I felt really quite alien in my own country, in England. In Scotland, I suppose, the argument I make in the book as well, that hill running is Scotland's national minority sport. People are doing it in Shetland and Orkney and the Western Isles. They're doing it in the middle of Edinburgh. They're doing it in the Borders. They're doing it across the Central Belt and the Highlands, Aberdeenshire. Old people are doing it. Young people are doing it. Men are doing it. Women are doing it. Women are often beating the men. It's a sport that everyone can take part in. And certainly in Scotland, I think it's extraordinarily friendly. And you'll finish a race, and you'll be standing there eating a load of cakes and drinking a cup of tea, and you'll be standing next to the guy or the woman who won the race, and you wouldn't know they've won the race because people are really low-key. And it's just very simple. Ego, that'd be the right word. There's no sort of ego. The people who are the best. In fact, they are probably the most introverted people who are at the very top of the sport.
So who are some of the kind of forgotten heroes of Scottish mountain running that we would do well to remember?
I don't know if forgotten's the word, but just sort of unknown. If the example, Angela Mudge, who was born with two club feet, literally her feet were pretty much facing in and facing pointing up, and she had spent 2.5 years with her feet in bandages to correct them. And when she was 30 years after she was born, she became a world champion in 2000. So, a woman overcoming extraordinary adversity. There's a guy called Finley Wilde, who people may well know about. He's probably Scotland's preeminent hill runner. His big goal was to become the fastest person to traverse the Coolin Ridge on Skye. And he got to the end of this ridge and he'd broken the record and everything was in place. But when he got to the end, he had a niggling doubt that something wasn't quite right. and he wondered if he'd touched one of the summits, because if he hadn't touched the summit, he hadn't officially done it.
Right.
He descended and he retraced his steps sort of in the glen and came back up to the mountain and thought he might have missed. And he got to the top and he realised that he hadn't touched the summit. But in terms of not touching the summit, it was literally he had passed within a few metres of summit cairn. So we're talking 5 to 10 seconds of time that he gained from this. But for him, you know, he couldn't claim this record. So he's a good example of the ethos of the sport. Nothing matters more than just doing things correctly.
Yeah, there's some real integrity there, isn't there? I mean, almost to a kind of almost unbelievable levels. That I mean,
it didn't matter to anyone.
Yeah,
and I guess another a genuine unknown hero. Unknown hero is a guy called Glyn Jones. And right. This guy ekes out a semi-reclusive existence in Wigtownshire in southwest Scotland. I've never met anyone who just does things for the sake of doing them. So he became the first guy in 2002 to run Ramsey Round in winter, and he did it in 55 hours in classic conditions. And he wasn't the sort of guy to wait for optimum conditions, i.e. not too much snow and it not being too cold. You know, he went when the conditions were diabolical, and 55 hours to cover 60 miles. And the quote that he said to me was, or that he wrote down actually in one of his reports, he said, the glory is in the doing, not in the having done. And that was something that I really took on board in my own efforts and still do now. The sense that in this sort of selfie culture and this sort of self-congratulatory culture that we live in, there's not enough of people like Glyn Jones just getting on with doing stuff just for the sake of it. So purely motivated by your own satisfaction, not motivated by sharing it, writing about it. And I'm as guilty of that as everyone else, but just doing it because you want to do it, because it's something that will make you happy. And I think, you know, that is the appeal of Hills. It gives people that level of satisfaction.
Yeah, that's great.
Without inviting an influx of people into the mountains, just a few of your favourite places and races in Scotland to run.
I think, so it comes back to an earlier point, you talk about commercialisation. I think we choose to commercialise places if we choose to all go and race there, but I think, you know, my favourite memories of being in Scotland and being hills is not racing, it's just running. I think I was in the Cairngorms last week, they're fantastic. Certainly the 23 Munros, the Ramsey Round, well, bewitched would be the word. You know, these hills bewitch me for years, and they, you know, I lie in bed at night and I think of these hills and I think of how to the best line to descend them or the best line to get on them, and you know, the details are fixed and they're lodged in my mind. But in terms of, I guess, favourite hills, they're not the most dramatic, but my local hills are Pentland. So I live in Edinburgh, and within 2 miles I can be in Pentland Hills, and I used to live in London, so I love the idea of knowing hills really, really well. So I go in them every single week and I watch the seasons change and watch the bracken come up and then die and the snow comes and I see the changing colour of the gorse. And I love these you know, fairly low, fairly benign hills, but just being able to know them, understand their moods, just a privilege, an absolute privilege.
That's great, Johnny. So with your book, it's out now, right? So if people are interested in the mountains of Calling, they can pick it up at their local bookshop or online. How do they do it?
Yes, it's The Mountains of Calling, as I said, which is the story of hill running in Scotland. It's available at all the usual outlets. So if it's not at your local bookshop, you can always ask for it in. I know Waterstones are stocking it fairly extensively, and all the usual online outlets. It's available there.
That's great. Well, Johnny, thank you very, very much for coming on the Runner's World podcast, telling us a little bit more about your book and also the mountain running scene in Scotland. It's been great to chat to you.
That's all right. Well, I hope some more people can get on the hills and feel the way some of us feel.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
In the current issue of Runner's World, we commissioned a feature looking at why recreational distance running is so white. Kerry McCarthy, the commission editor, is here to discuss some of the findings.
Afternoon.
How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you.
So, Kerry, running by rights should be the most inclusive sport in the world, but it's not, is it?
No, it's quite surprising. Although, Having said that, not that surprising, considering we commissioned a feature on this, and we wouldn't have done that if we suspected that it was that everything was hunky dory in the running
scene. Dark.
Yeah. But some really interesting stuff came back from this. I think the simplest way to boil it down is that everybody agrees that while running is probably the most accessible sport out there, that old trope about all you need is a pair of trainers and a bit of willpower, that while that's certainly true, once you scratch below the surface, there are further barriers to entry for ethnic minority groups.
Right.
One of them being lack of role models. It boils down to about two. One of them is lack of role models in the mainstream media, in the advertising, the way that these runners are targeted or not targeted. The feedback we got was that they're not seeing themselves represented from the brands in the way the brands are marketing to them.
Right.
And the other reason is it's kind of socioeconomic, really. As much as you don't need much money to get going, I think certainly with first-generation immigrants, they feel as though running is luxury. And actually, I'm just going to read a little bit out from the feature from one of the contributors, who said, "For some communities, sport is right down their list. You've got education, you've got religion, you've got work and family. Running clubs could do a lot more in terms of empathising and understanding this. It's not just about promoting runs, it's about creating an environment where people feel welcome." And we went on to a guy called Harmander Singh, who's one of the Runners World Pacers at the London Marathon. He started the running group Sikhs in the City.
Yeah, yeah.
He's coached 300 runners from a BAME background. And he kind of just added to that and said, look, particularly when it comes to the Asian community, but anyone who's come to Britain for a better economic livelihood, they've worked their butts off to get established, and they don't value leisure as much as the white indigenous community. Leisure is a luxury for those who can afford it.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? You actually think about running, like, if you've had a very hard life, physically hard life, in your spare time, are you likely to go and, or what little spare time you have, think, oh, I'd like a 10K out of this. I get that.
Yeah. I think what we're seeing is that as much as, you know, certainly in the magazine we talk about things like it can be a stress reliever, it's head time, anybody can do it, and all of those things are true, but there are sections of society that don't see it like that. They equate running with, well, this is a frippery.
Yes. Okay.
You know, yeah. And who are we to tell them otherwise? It's they're so busy trying to keep their heads above water, and there were some really interesting statistics in the piece about some of the poorest boroughs and communities and cities in the UK. Mm. And when you looked at how poor they were, there was a direct correlation to how unhealthy they were and how little exercise they did, not just running, but any kind of exercise. They were just, you know, without wanting to kind of dramatise it, they were just kind of too busy trying to stay alive, really.
Mm. I think as well, when you take into cost of living, if you're taking money, when it comes to the point when you're putting food on a table, what that food is the cheapest food you can get. That has a direct impact on health, but also that's where your money's going. That's what you're spending it on. It's not a matter of, like, I've got extra for running shoes or kit or those sorts of things. So the two things kind of go hand in hand slightly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think so. Do you get a sense of what we might do to redress some of those problems?
I think there's some stuff being done. It seems to me, having looked into this, that we're at a stage where the lack of diversity is being recognised, and people are starting to scratch their heads and stroke their chins and go, we've just noticed this, we need to do something about this.
Yeah,
I wouldn't say that we're too far along in terms of initiatives, but there are some things being done. You will remember Donna Fraser, possibly, who ran in the Sydney Olympics in the 400 metres final with Cathy Freeman. You know, Aboriginal runner. She ran in the weird kind of bodysuit.
Yeah,
she was carrying the hopes of not just Australia but an Indigenous people on her back. And I think Donna Fraser came fourth, I think, in that race. But she is now working as a diversity inclusion officer for Sport England, which is the first time they've ever had a role like that. They kind of created it. Not for her, but they realised the need of the role, and she said, right, I want to get involved in that. Yeah. And she thinks there should be a much better emphasis, link placed between sport and the health service in this country. Mm. You know, we're starting to realise how good it is for your mental health, obviously how good it can be for your physical health, kind of heart disease and obesity and things like that.
Yeah.
And she just wants us to keep relentlessly banging the drum on this, many of the listeners may have read or seen chat in the last 6-12 months about trying to get exercise prescribed on the NHS instead of just being a pill-popping nation.
Social prescribing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of there being a pill for everything, it's like, actually, could this be solved by exercise? What type of exercise? What intensity? Go and do it. There's talk now of park run being prescribed on the NHS.
Yeah. Yeah, Kate was mentioning that early on, and I think, yeah, I mean, all that stuff feels like a more enlightened way of dealing with those problems, doesn't it?
It's progressive.
It's progressive, yeah.
Rather than sort of, just as you say, a prescribed, here's a bottle of this and take it, and
yeah,
that sort of approach.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Harmander, who we talked about a few minutes ago, thinks that there's not necessarily a problem when it comes to the grassroots. He says, look, when you start out in running, it's the most non-racially discriminating sport you can imagine. But as soon as you go into any kind of supervisory role, it's like the mentality of the old working men's club kicks in. You're not made to feel welcome, and people make presumptions about where you come from. He thinks that, you know, that if you get into anywhere where you're going to be a coach or a chief executive, then you just don't have a chance. And certainly the statistics back that up. I've got a study here from Sporting Equals, which is a UK-based charity, in 2016 that found that across 68 sports boards, including national governing bodies, there was just one BAME chairman, one CEO, and 26 board members, 4% of the total. Only 3% of coaches were from ethnic minority backgrounds. 3%. So when you go back to that question of role models and who do I look up to?
Yeah, staggeringly low, isn't it? Staggeringly low amount of that.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the questions we've been asking readers, and I guess it comes into our sort of 25th anniversary stuff coming up, is where they think running might be in 25 years' time. Do you see this situation changing quickly? Is kind of BAME running a bit of a sleeping giant? Or do you think that actually this is going to be the way it is for some time?
I don't think it's going to be a sleeping giant, or it's suddenly going to awaken a massive force of BAME runners. But I think the numbers will be more evened out. I think that, like I said, now there's a recognition that there's a problem. People will start doing things. The London Marathon have definitely recognised this. I think theirs is one of the stories that we should pay heed to. They launched an event this year, which we paced at, called the Big Half, in London. And what London Marathon did was they got Mo Farah to kind of spearhead the campaign, and they actively went after the BAME community. They ran a campaign which was aimed at recruiting a field that they say reflected the cultural diversity of London. And the way they went about that, they had teams, I think they call them outreach teams, which worked with community groups, they worked with sports clubs and faith institutions in the four host boroughs, which I think were Tower Hamlets, Southwark, Lewisham and Greenwich. And in those boroughs, 69% of the residents are from ethnic minorities. So they offered discounted entry of £10, which I think they offered, that was to offer to a total of 7,500 runners. Yeah. And they banged the drum, they made them aware that this event was happening. They encouraged them to take part in it, and they offered them a discount. And the upshot was that instead of London Marathon, say, normally the events that they put on, because they have events, as we know, other than just the London Marathon.
Sure.
Normally, in the field, an average field for one of their events, 8% of the people will be from a BAME background. And right. In this race, that figure rose to 18%.
Yeah, huge, isn't it? Yeah.
So for a first go, that's...
More than double. Yeah.
You know, it shows that paying some attention to people who feel that you're not really speaking their language can pay dividends if you do it in the right way.
Yeah. Kerry, thank you very, very much for coming
no problem.
On to speak about subject. Like I said, it's a huge subject and not one that we can completely do justice to in 20 minutes. But we would love to hear from our listeners. Tell us what you think. As running as inclusive as it should be, as diverse, let us know at podcast@runnersworld.co.uk.
Actually, I just wanted to add to that as well. If you have got a story, if you know of a group or a community in your area that is tackling this, or you think we've completely got this wrong and it's more inclusive and you've got examples to prove why, we don't intend this one piece that we've done to be the end of the subject. We want to keep coming back to it. We want to gather information on it, and we would love to hear about any anecdotes or stories you've got, both good and bad.
Yeah, so drop us an email, podcast@runnersworld.co.uk.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
So that brings us to the end of this month's Runner's World podcast. I want to say a big thank you to our guests, Kate Carter, Johnny Muir and Kerry McCarthy, and to Scramble Studios in Soho, where this was recorded.
For more from Runner's World, please visit the website, runnersworld.co.uk, where you'll find news, reviews, interviews and everything else from the wide world of running.
If you like what you've heard, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next month.
The Runner's World podcast was recorded at Scramble Studios, Soho.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.